for tuning in to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Megan Marone.
And I'm Kristen Parsons. We've got a great program planned for you.
Today, Sam Trumbor is visiting the studio. Sam is a longtime practitioner of Buddhist mindfulness meditation and the head of the First Unitarian Universalist Society in Albany. He's in the studio to talk about the mental, physical, and emotional benefits of meditation.
Then we'll have Practical Physics with David Borton. Dr. Borton will be discussing the energy output of your average human on planet Earth in 2017.
Afterwards, Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute explains federal tax cuts.
Now, let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who was the first senator to call for Al Franken to step down, now says that President Donald Trump should resign due to credible accusations that he engaged in sexual misconduct dating back to the 1970s. Gillibrand said that if he doesn't resign, Congress should hold hearings into the allegations by 16 women. On Monday, a group of the women who leveled charges against Trump called for a congressional investigation.
China is planning to build 5 refugee camps on its border with North Korea. This is an indication that Beijing is preparing for a potential conflict, presumably between the United States and North Korea. A local paper near the border also published tips on how people can protect themselves from a nuclear weapon attack or explosion. China and Russia began air defense drills on Monday, military officials announced, as the United States and its Asian allies launched their own war games. China and Russia have both voiced concern over the deployment of U.S. TAD, or Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missiles, in South Korea.
The Pentagon said it will begin processing transgender applicants to the military on January 1st. On Monday, a federal judge declined to put the deadline on hold. The Justice Department appealed the judge's ruling to a D.C.-based federal appeals court. Transgender service members are challenging President Donald Trump's effort to bar transgender Americans from military service.
The State Board of Regents made it easier for students with disabilities to graduate from high school, essentially eliminating the requirement that they pass any Regents exams. This goes beyond last year's changes to loosen the graduation requirements for these students, the New York Times reports. The students would instead need to earn a credential showing they had the skills for entry-level employment. Students would still have to take 5 Regents exams, and the district superintendent would have to review their coursework to determine if they showed proficiency in the subjects for which they did not pass the exam. Individuals graduating this way would receive what is known as a local diploma rather than a Regents diploma. For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
With us now is Sam Trumbor, the minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany. Sam has been a student of Buddhist mindfulness meditation since 1985. He's a former president of the UU Buddhist Fellowship, and he regularly hosts meditation classes that are open to the public. These classes and meditation sessions are held at the First Unitarian Universalist Society on Washington Avenue in Albany. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So can you tell us about yourself? Who are you and how did you get involved with Buddhist mindfulness meditation?
Well, serving as a Unitarian Universalist minister, people might think it's a little odd that I also do Buddhist meditation as well. And there are a number of Unitarian Universalist ministers who are also very interested in meditation and have a meditation practice. For me, I started in meditation back in 1985 when I was doing an exploration of my spirit. I lived in Berkeley, California, a great place to do that kind of exploration. And I discovered an interesting group of people that I was with, and they were doing psychic healing. And one of them said, you know, you might be interested in meditation. There's a class at this place. And so I went to the class. When I showed up, it was the wrong day, but it was open, and I sat in there and felt very at home. And when I came back the next time when the class actually started, it was really wonderful experience because when they explained the first of the central teachings of Buddhism, I felt like I had come home. And it's what's interesting to me is that sometimes when people come to our congregation, they also have that kind of experience where they'll go sit through a service and feel like, this is what I think, is what I believe, and how did I not know about it? Well, that was true for me about Buddhism. I'd never heard about Buddhism before, and I immediately jumped right in and started meditating and was ready to do a retreat after maybe a year or so.
So you've developed meditation workshops at the First Unitarian Universalist Society, and presumably you bring into those classes and workshops all the experience you have since that first time you stepped into a studio.
Yes. The most important part about doing meditation is that it's a practice. So you're practicing doing meditation so that you can develop qualities of consciousness. And the most important quality of consciousness that we develop with this kind that I teach is mindfulness. And mindfulness is a quality of consciousness that is not always present in our minds. If you consciously take a breath in and know that you're breathing in, mindfulness is present. But if you are breathing normally, you might not even notice that you're breathing. And so you can use this cultivating this mindfulness quality over time, and you can develop it. And so the goal of mindfulness, developing this mindfulness, is that it allows you to see clearly moment-to-moment experience. And when you're watching moment-to-moment experience, you can see directly the way things are. And the Buddha had some theories about the way things are. When you can witness them for yourself, you can validate them. So Buddhism is a very reality-based religion. Again, Unitarian Universalism really connects well on this score because we are also very reality-based religious tradition. We're not that interested in the supernatural. We're not that interested in heaven or hell. We're really interested in how we live in this world, which is exactly what Buddhism is focused on too. So in terms of what I do, on Sundays from 9 to 9:45, I have meditation that we have a short reading for about 10 minutes. Then we sit together for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and then I give people explanation about how to do the meditation. Then we have some conversation afterwards, and then we close with a loving kindness meditation to dedicate the value, the merit of what we're doing for the benefit of all beings. Ultimately, the Buddha wanted everyone to become awakened, and these methods are really helpful to help people develop clear thinking, clear minds, and to see things as they are, and in that process become enlightened. Because really, what is enlightenment but this quality of clear consciousness?
You have written, in doing a little research on the crossover in your writing and in your life, mm-hmm. between Unitarianism and Buddhism, a quote by you, Sam, is, "True heaven is the state of the soul. It is inward goodness. It is the love of God in the heart going out into the life and character." So, as you just said, there isn't necessarily some focus within your own spiritual life on the metaphysical necessarily before or after embodiment.
I'm really open to the concept that there is a metaphysical, but that's not where the focus, especially of Buddhism, is. The Buddha talked about the fact that we have access to paranormal consciousness, extrasensory perception. He also talked a lot about past lives. You don't have to believe in those things to practice the meditation. The meditation is very fruitful whether or not you believe those things. And so that's been our approach, is to try to help people develop their mental skills, in a sense, developing the ability to concentrate, to be able to hold your mind in one object, to develop this quality of moment-to-moment awareness. Those two together can help you develop a very clear, powerful mind, which can, again, lets you see things directly as they are.
So what are some of the brain benefits of meditation?
Some of the ones that I was just talking about, developing. There's a lot of religious traditions that talk about developing concentration. You can use mantras. You can focus on a candle flame. Mantra or just doing singing can be very powerful in developing an entrancement state, which can be very helpful. What the benefits for the mind with Buddhism is, again, this developing the ability of the mind to recognize things as they are. One of the things that the Buddha really wanted us to do is by seeing things as they are, we can develop wisdom. The other place is when you are feeling connected with another person or when you're in the present moment and you can have a connected experience with somebody, you can also develop a lot of compassion. So the big benefits of doing this kind of practice are developing both wisdom and compassion.
So I've been lucky enough to do some meditation workshops with you, and I know that we are silent in parts of those workshops and that you've gone on extended silent meditation
Yes.
retreats. What is the purpose of that? And what are the benefits of doing a silent meditation retreat?
What's challenging with doing this kind of mental development is the process of distraction. If you try to watch your breath for 10 breaths, you're probably going to experience the mind wandering. And that's because we're so charged by all the things that are going on around us. One of the things that really is wonderful about going to a meditation retreat is that it's very quiet and there's not a lot of stimulation so that your mind can settle. And just as your mind will settle, your body will settle too. And in that place, the mind sort of slows down. And this process of mindfulness, of being able to be aware of your thoughts, to be aware of your feelings, to be aware of your physical sensations, those kinds of experiences are going to be very helpful to you if they're, you can perceive them as discrete events rather than a cluster of things that are happening. So if you can watch a thought arise and pass away, or a feeling arise and pass away, you can have an experience of the truth of impermanence. If you experience deep silence on a retreat where you're not thinking, you might be able to experience the emptiness of self, that the self is a created construct. Very challenging thing for Westerners to understand, but in the East, it's a more common understanding. And then one of the other core teachings of the Buddha was the concept of, many people talk about it as suffering, but this quality of unsatisfactoriness that is present in existence. And you can see directly when an experience of things not being the way you want them arise, and then you can see your mental reaction to that. Because this is where all of our suffering comes from. We know that unpleasant things happen in our lives that we can't control, but we have a fair amount of can develop a fair amount of control of how we respond to those things. And you don't know what your programming is around responding to unpleasantness in existence until it arises in the moment. And so at a meditation retreat, you can see that happen much, much more clearly. And so then you can decide, do I want to do this or not? Which brings me to one of the most important things, benefits for mindfulness development, is the ability to choose, to develop this ability. When you see an opportunity through mindfulness of an opportunity for action, it's so much better to be able to choose a skillful response rather than a reactive, unskillful response. And that's what you get when you do mindfulness development, because your mind is less, much, much less reactive.
Very interesting. We have another question. So how did California culture influence your perspective on religion and spirituality?
Well, I was in California from 77 to about 89, and it was a time of a lot of growth and development for me as a person. I was going to college, sort of a lot of formulation. I I grew up in Newark, Delaware, and then went to California to find myself, is what you used to do in the 70s, is go find yourself. I don't know if people still do that anymore, but I hope they do. At any rate, I was out there, and there's just so many different religious groups out there. I hung out with Guru Mai. I went to Dances of Universal Peace, which are here in the Capital Region as well, at the Abode. So I got it. I sampled a lot of different kinds of religious experiences out there, and also at the time reconnected with my Unitarian Universalism, because I grew up Unitarian Universalist and have been and continue to try to figure out how all these things fit together.
Any California gnosis?
I don't know that I did have a profound religious experience when I was in California that changed the direction of my life in 1980. But that, I don't know if that was a California experience or not. I was playing a game of chess and had this really beautiful experience of agape or universal love, or what the Buddha would call loving kindness, this love for everyone, a love without an object. And it really changed the direction of my life. So I have to say, I could thank California for that. Berkeley, California for that. Not Southern California so much.
So maybe this idea of agape will translate into this question, because one thing I've always wondered about is obviously there's this tension between the Buddhist idea of letting go and transience and permanence, and then the human experience of all of the things that we want to hold on to, whether we're talking about as you're a Unitarian, the leader of this religious community, spiritual community, and the idea that one of the mission statements of the Unitarian Universalist Society is social justice. So is there a tension, do you see, between the Buddhist conception of letting go and the very real need and desire to hang on to certain ideals, whether those ideals are very personal ideals, like wanting to be connected to other humans in the course of a fleeting lifetime, or ideals like social justice movements such as Black Lives Matter, the fight for disability rights, gender equity, class equity. Do you see a tension between those two things, or is there a way to navigate those two states of consciousness?
The challenge for the Buddha, which started him on his journey, was trying to understand suffering. He witnessed a person who was sick and dying. He saw someone who was old. He saw a dead body, and he saw a mendicant monk. And those are the motivators that got him on his spiritual search in the first place. And so that engagement with suffering is a core part of Buddhist teachings. And certainly being engaged with suffering in the world is a big issue for a lot of people who are involved in socially engaged Buddhism. We in the West, I think, have been far more engaged in that than perhaps in the East, partly because of the influence of the idea of karma, or the idea of rebirth, or different statuses, different stations, caste concepts, which the Buddha was very rejecting of, is the concept of caste. So if I was a monk trying to attain enlightenment, I think there might be a problem with trying to follow that path. But as a worldling, somebody who's involved in the world and trying to find a way to bring the work of Unitarian Universalism, which is very socially engaged on all of the issues that you mentioned, with Buddhism, which can help us develop a clear, again, that clear consciousness, that mindfulness, so that we can better understand what actually works to make a difference on those areas. Because certainly you can be very engaged in a lot of different social justice activities and make things worse rather than better, which is really disturbing as I've looked back over some of the things my congregation or our movement has tried to do where we've been less than stellar in our results. My hope is that we're making at least a successive approximation towards the good.
To expand this conversation out universally, I know David Lynch, the filmmaker, has been a big advocate of getting meditation into school systems. So do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that one of the great values of mindfulness and developing compassion especially, and there are compassion practices that you can do which are basically loving kindness practices, and in those in schools, developing students' ability to connect in with this feeling of loving kindness and then sharing it with other students is great for developing connection. And then the concentration skills, learning how to focus your mind on one object and stay focused, is really good for their academics and things like that. So between compassion and then just developing wisdom in general, and then I think certainly some of the Buddhist teachings would be really helpful too, for them developing good ethical moral principles. So those are things that which, of course, Christian and Jewish, Muslim, any of these other traditions, we find a common core of morality that I think we can emphasize that we would want to develop in a public school setting.
Well, we would love to have you back on the show. These conversations could definitely extend. So thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Sam Trembor, a Buddhist mindfulness meditation practitioner and the spiritual leader of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine for more interviews with spiritual and religious leaders in the Capital Region.
Dr. Carl Sagan pioneered popular science education through his television show Cosmos on PBS, A Personal Voyage. He passed away in 1996, but his legacy lives on. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is one of his students, has taken over as host of a new season in Cosmos. And right here in the studios of WOOC, we have our own popular physics maverick, Dr. David Borton. Dr. Borton is a solar boat builder. He crafted the Solar Sal, a beautiful fossil fuel-free ship that cruises the Hudson and the Erie Canal, and he's a teacher. Dr. Sagan once said that science is a way of thinking. In this segment of Popular Physics, Dr. Borden talks about the way to think about how we burn energy and how as human beings we are so unavoidably tied to the light of the sun.
Back with David Borton and our popular physics, popular science segment, and we're talking about the law of physics, that is. David, kind of a random and personal question for you. What do you weigh?
Well, 5.
What?
5.
Wait a minute. That doesn't make sense.
Why doesn't it make sense?
I mean, first of all, maybe I shouldn't be asking you such an awkward question, but 5... You'd have to be a form of Thumbelina or something.
Well, see, that's because you and I, haven't talked about what the unit is. And I actually weigh something close to 5 slugs. Now, slugs is a unit. And you didn't know that, did you?
No.
Okay. So 5 slugs, slugs being about 30 pounds. So 5 times that's actually 32 pounds. I weigh about 175 pounds. But notice I gave a number and a unit.
Okay.
Okay?
And slugs, we're spelling slugs like the animal, S-L-U-G-S?
That's how you spell it, but it's actually a mass like 32 pounds.
And where is that measurement used?
Subtle physics.
Well, how tall are you?
Meters.
Okay, well, that time, you didn't give me a number.
So I could give you a number and I could say 2 meters. That's not quite as accurate as if I said 5 feet, 10.5 inches, giving numbers and unit. Now, tell me about mathematics. Are there units in mathematics?
No.
That's right. Mathematics deals with pure numbers.
Mm-hmm.
In physics, you use numbers and talk about the units.
Mm-hmm.
Because you talk about a person's weight, you have to have some units to go with it. Now, do you know your weight exactly?
No.
No. You can't know things like this exactly. Mm-hmm. Whereas with mathematics, you can say 1 plus 1 is exactly 2.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a pound, you don't know that it's exactly a pound. If you have a second pound, you add it together, you add two things that you don't know exactly what they are. And so there's always some, you know, error or unknown in when you say a number like 175 pounds.
Well, how old are you?
Well, I'm about 27,000 days. Okay, so, let me give another one. During my life, my heart has pumped about 2 million gallons of blood.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's another way of saying the same kind of thing.
Much more interesting way of saying the same thing.
But obscure, right?
More, you know, again, as a poetry lover, a little more metaphorical, for
okay.
sure.
But typically people measure their age in years.
Right. So why the difficult answers to simple questions?
The first one, we were talking about mass, okay? Then the next one, we were talking about length.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one, we're talking about time.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the basic things that we talk about in physics. When we talk about something, we're usually talking about it in terms of mass, length, and time.
Things that have properties we measure in numbers, right?
Numbers and units.
So, again, could you give us a practical application for why it's important to think about the basic items in physics, mass, length, and time?
You've bought a pound of butter, okay? When you buy a pound of butter, you want to know that it's a pound, okay? And you probably don't want it to be a brick. You want it to be butter.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think it's pretty important to know what you're talking about. And that's the nice thing about physics, because physics, I can't tell you that the acceleration of gravity is 57 feet per second per second, because that'd be a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody would know that I was not telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's 32 feet per second per second.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's real. It's like these laws. It's universal.
So math is pure numbers, but real things aren't pure, right? We're in the world of approximation.
Real things have properties, but we can't know those properties as exactly as mathematics knows pure numbers.
So what's the point of that?
Well, we were talking about rocket science, and if you have a rocket, you want to know how much it's going to weigh when it takes off. Well, you can't know that weight exactly, but you want to know that weight as exactly as possible so that the rocket can actually take off and go where you want. When you shoot your basketball, as we talked about last time, you want to know what the weight of that basketball is, because that determines how hard you push on the basketball when you take a basketball shot. Well, let me ask you a question. What do you know about Einstein?
Einstein, I know, worked for a little while on the Manhattan Project at Columbia University and then dropped out. Einstein was a genius.
Well, so was Newton. And last week you figured out Newton's laws, right?
Yes. And Einstein's famous discovery, right? E equals MC squared.
That's very good. And what does E stand for?
Energy.
Okay. And what's the most important energy in your life?
Well, would say coffee, but I think it's the sun.
Yes. Okay. That's a whole other subject. We can talk about that another time, solar energy. What do you know about Einstein's equation for energy?
An equation that has to do with the speed of light.
Okay. Now tell me what you know about speed. When you're driving a car, what's your speed?
Let's say 40. MPH, miles per hour.
Right. So a speed is a length divided by a time. Ah, doesn't that ring a bell?
Mm-hmm.
Basic physics. Okay, so let's go back to the equation. What is E?
Energy, matter, times the speed of light squared.
So if speed is length divided by time, what is speed squared?
Could you repeat the question?
Okay, if speed is length divided by time, what is speed squared? Einstein said there was an M in there, right? M times
right.
C squared.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got mass times length divided by time divided by time.
Okay.
And whenever you have something like that, that's energy. Here we are with these basic things, mass, length, and time, and we've already moved on to energy. What does energy do for you?
It allows me to move in the world.
What else are you doing besides moving?
Breathing, talking, singing, dancing, listening, thinking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things you can't do unless you have energy.
Hmm.
And where does this energy come from?
Well, ultimately traceable. All of it is traceable back to the sun.
So solar energy will be one of the things we'll talk about in another segment.
Exciting. Now, just to make sure that I fully understand, though, and our listenership understands, what do you see as the utmost importance of E equals MC squared?
Taking it for granted is not what I'm hoping you're doing.
Well, not
you're
take
learning
it, for
it learning it, and realizing it's part of your life every day, all day. The sun, for instance, changes mass into energy, and that energy radiates out into space, and some of that energy is intercepted by this little tiny ball in space called the Earth. And that energy is what provides for all of life on Earth. That's E equals MC squared.
Can that equation be traceable as being incredibly important going all the way back to, like, the Big Bang, obviously?
Obviously,
we're talking about
this
applying way out in the limits of the cosmos.
That's absolutely correct. So isn't that a good thing to know?
Yes. If you have a vision of the cosmos, you need to know that.
Now, there are lots of other ways to look at energy. The basketball that you just shot, it has kinetic energy, right? Because it's moving. Mm-hmm. It also has potential energy because you've lifted it up and it can fall down. Mm-hmm. So those are other kinds of energy. And those energies happen to come from you because you had food and it was an energy in your muscles that went on and made the ball go. So all these energies are related.
So will you be talking about potential energy with solar energy and the applications of solar energy?
Sure.
For example, in a solar boat?
Sure, but not today.
Well, could you explain in our final moments together how you got into solar energy in particular? Was it E equals MC squared?
Sort of. I was in graduate school and I studied nuclear physics. Nuclear physics has a lot of E equals MC squared in it. But then I said that, you know, we couldn't buy gasoline. And so I looked around at all the forms of energy that you could use, coal, natural gas, hydro, wind, etc. And it turns out that solar is the one that makes the most sense for this planet. And so I've been in solar ever since then.
Now, going back to the E equals MC squared thing, so that is universally applicable. So when you're talking about the energy of a human, so they run a 10-minute mile. E equals MC squared would apply to what breakdown of that understanding of a human running the 10-minute mile?
From physics, you go to quantum physics. And quantum physics gives you chemistry. And chemistry then gives you biology. And in biology, you eat the food and it digests and it goes into your system. And in all of those stages, a change in energy has a change with mass related to it. So E equals mc squared. But c squared is such a big number, you don't really notice that.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't lose a lot of weight just by picking up a pencil. Okay, mm-hmm. But all these energy transformations are taking place in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew?
I think it's one of those universal things. The speed of light part was always the thing that was hard for me to concretize in my imagination in terms of because it's like impossible to almost have like a visual metaphor for what that means.
Okay, you know? That's fine. That means nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it happens in the sun. Have you ever been in the sun? No.
Mm-mm.
That's where these nuclear reactions happen.
Hmm.
They happen in atomic bombs. Okay, so you want to be away from those nuclear reactors. It happens in nuclear reactors. But the change in mass happens in a chemistry thing. You can't see it when you take two hydrogens and combine it with one oxygen. You change from gases to water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you don't see the change in mass that happens there, but it happens. And so you take the mass of hydrogen and the mass of oxygen, you put them together and you get the total mass.
Okay.
Because that's not a nuclear reaction. It's the nuclear reactions where you see E equals MC squared.
Thank you. You're helping me because what I'm starting to realize is that the physics part of it is the delineation of the laws that the other sciences are going to be also not controlled by, but
Dependent upon,
exactly. Which is why I've also heard that the science curriculums in high schools have been considered a little topsy-turvy for a while, that actually, you know, the standard protocol is to have 9th and 10th graders learning earth science and biology, and then you take your chemistry junior year and your physics senior year. And a lot of school districts are now switching so that you take physics freshman year and then chemistry and then biology and earth science, because then you move from the kind of universal laws into the specific applications in biology and earth science of those laws.
Good insight. Now, I happen to have taken physics fairly early on, and my physics teacher was really good because he would tell me something like, you know, this has a high temperature. Mm-hmm. He would wet his finger and he would touch it, and you would hear fsss, and you would smell burning flesh. Mm-hmm. And you believed this guy. Mm-hmm. You know, physics is truth. Okay, and then he would do another experiment. He would say, this thing has electricity in it. He'd put his finger near it. Gazap! You would hear the spark. You would see the spark. And you knew that this guy is telling the truth, that physics is truth.
Poor guy. Yeah.
No, he was right. Now, my sister had the same guy, okay? Now, she didn't think this was, you know, this didn't appeal to her, okay? But my sister does all kinds of things that require understanding the laws of physics, like playing tennis. She likes to play tennis. Mm-hmm. Now, how does a tennis ball move? Well, you just told me how a basketball moved. And so a tennis ball moves in much the same way. Hmm. And so she was applying Newton's three laws, right? Mm-hmm. But she didn't know it. And maybe she'd have been a better tennis player if she knew that.
Hmm. It's interesting how these laws also challenge our ideas of freedom and democracy. We love that word in America, but we're all wrapped in these laws, you know? Bob Dylan has a line where he says, even the birds are chained to the sky. I don't know if that's exactly a physics application, but, you know, we need to know these laws that we're bound to.
Yeah, and we're all in the same boat when it comes to these laws. These laws apply to all of us, everywhere, every time, no matter who we are, no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing, these laws apply to us equally.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show again, David. I don't know if this is going to propel me like a basketball towards an PhD in physics, but you're certainly helping our understanding of physics, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Physics is fun.
Physics is fun. David Borton's going to be back in just a few minutes. We're going to hear more from him about solar energy in a pre-recorded segment. But for those of you just tuning in, I'm Megan Marone.
And I'm Kristen Parsons. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, where we're broadcasting from, check us out at mediasanctuary.org.
And now WOOC correspondent Mark Dunlay interviews Ron Deutsch about the issues and concerns regarding the process and impacts of the GOP tax bill.
We're here talking with Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. Obviously, people are very concerned about what is going on at the federal level in terms of the various tax cut proposals that have been passed by the Senate and House. We've heard a lot of concerns about how the elimination or modification of deduction of state taxes will impact upon New York State. Ron, what are some of the other issues that groups like the Fiscal Policy Institute are concerned about?
Well, we're concerned about any number of issues in this tax bill. First and foremost, we're concerned about the fact that it tends to be stilted towards the wealthiest among us. They would probably be the ones that do the best. But it's really an interesting tax bill because I think, you know, it's got a lot of winners and losers. So some people in New York will do better than others, depending on the size of their family, their income levels, and a variety of other variables. So despite the fact that, you know, they're saying they want to simplify the tax code, in reality, what they're doing is just changing the tax code, and you're basically picking winners and losers. So you'll find that a lot of families in New York State are going to see tax increases. Some may see tax decreases. Some may see basically the same level of taxation. But the reality is that this definitely is stilted towards the wealthiest.
Now, there's been a fair amount of controversy about the speed that this tax bill has been moving forward. The Senate passed a bill literally in the middle of the night. There have been apparently no public hearings on this. Has the public really been given any opportunity to weigh in? And do lawmakers actually know what they're voting on?
You know, I think when they voted on this bill, they really had no clue as to what they were voting on. It was hundreds and hundreds of pages. And, you know, as many senators pointed out, you know, there were a lot of handwritten notations in the final bill as well. It's just no way to do business. I mean, I think when you're making these dramatic reforms and, you know, kind of once in a generation reforms to the tax code, it should be done in a much more thoughtful and deliberative fashion. So this notion that, you know, it has to be done at lightning speed, we have to deliver it to the president's desk before Christmas, you know, just is sad. It's a sad commentary on the state of politics right now. But I think they realize the more people know about this tax bill, the less support there is for it. And clearly, when you look at the public opinion polls, the majority of Americans aren't supporting this tax cut package. You know, they have some very real concerns. So, you know, the Senate and the House, you know, this conference committee process, quite frankly, is going to be a sham. I think, you know, all these decisions are going to be made at the top leadership levels when they try to reconcile some of the differences between the two bills. So, you know, the reality is what we really need to do is put the brakes on this process and hold some serious hearings to discuss what the impact is going to be. But it really seems like it's the blue states, if you will, that are taking it on the chin here. I mean, I don't think anybody can argue that fact. It's states like California, New Jersey, New York, Maryland, Illinois, states with generally higher taxes at the local level and state level. But they're also the states that contribute more to the federal government than they get back in services. So, you know, they're really kind of targeting the cash cows, if you will, across this country, and basically, you know, providing the tax cuts, the majority of the tax cuts to red states.
Now, two of the issues that have gotten a fair amount of attention has been the treatment of health care, including the individual mandate, and also how apparently graduate students would be impacted. Could you briefly explain what those two issues are?
Sure. So in particular on the health care side, right, the House, you know, obviously had many efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, many of which, you know, fell short, certainly, on the Senate side. But the reality is, you know, the House doesn't deal with health care in its tax bill, which is a good thing, right? You know, we shouldn't be dealing with the health care issue at the same time we're dealing with the tax issue. I think they're two totally separate and distinct issues. But the Senate, on the other hand, what they do is they repeal the individual mandate that was in the Affordable Care Act that requires people to purchase insurance or pay a penalty if they don't. Right. So what that's basically going to do is once you remove the individual mandate, a lot of people will drop out. A lot of then premiums will rise and then people won't be able to afford health care any longer. So estimates have been as high as 13 million people losing access to their health care coverage. So, you know, this to me is one of the most significant differences between the House and the Senate bills. So it remains to be seen how that's going to be reconciled and whether or not that stays in or it goes out. So, you know, another toward the other end of what you were talking about, we're realizing that, you know, graduate students often get their tuition paid in exchange for the work that they do on campus. And basically what the bill would do then is tax that tuition amount, making it almost impossible for many students to continue to go to school because they're not going to be able to afford the taxes on that significant amount of tuition. So, you know, the reality is that there's so many things that are being changed. changed in this tax bill. I wouldn't necessarily call it a simplification. One of the other interesting points is, you know, many of the benefits to lower income individuals tend to sunset earlier on, while many of the benefits to wealthy individuals, like the estate tax and the, you know, reduction in the corporate tax, continue on regardless. So I think, you know, it becomes very clear that, again, you know, this benefits the wealthy more than the poor and working class. And what we really need is to be able to make sure that we have a bottom-up approach to tax reform, right? This trickle-down approach clearly doesn't work. You know, we've seen it happen before. It didn't result in the type of growth that people suggested it would, yet here we are again, you know, deja vu all over again, where they're projecting these, you know, incredible amount of growth in the economy as a result of these tax cuts, when in reality we know that's not going to happen.
Could you maybe outline how some of the New York State congressional delegation is standing on this these tax proposals, and particularly, you know, the local ones here in the area, Faso, Tomko, and Stefanik?
Yeah, sure. So at this point, you know, the House already passed their tax bill. And they, and the way they treated the state and local tax deduction, right? So initially they eliminated the state and local tax deduction, and then in their revision, they basically said that we will allow people to deduct the first $10,000 in property taxes that they pay. But they don't allow for the deduction of income taxes. So, again, that hurts states like New York. So members of Congress in this district, Congressman Faso, Congressman Tomko, and Congresswoman Stefanik, thankfully all voted against the tax cut package that the House was advancing. We're hoping that they're going to continue with that no vote as we move on to the final version. You know, we also had some downstate Republican members of Congress, like Congressman Zeldin, Congressman King, voting against this bill as well, because they know it's going to hurt their constituents. And, you know, they're going to be running again for re-election, so they certainly don't want to be running for re-election knowing that they increase taxes on many of their constituents. I think they know better than that. They know that this is bad for New York, and they voted accordingly. So now it's really about, you know, putting some pressure on these members to continue that no vote, and, you know, helping them realize that, hey, this compromise bill is still bad for New York, and, you know, we need our members to vote against it.
Now, both houses are now negotiating, or will begin negotiating, the differences between the two bills. Apparently, they would come back, you know, for a final vote in both houses. Can you maybe outline what the timeline is expected to be for this process? And, you know, for the listeners who may be concerned about how their taxes will be impacted, you know, how can they weigh in?
Right. So, you know, the timeline is a little bit unclear. You know, they're right now they were choosing members to serve on the conference committee that will, you know, try and iron out the differences. But as I said, you know, that is a bit of a sham. It seems like this is really going to take place at the leadership level. So negotiations are already underway as to how we can, you know, fix the differences between the two bills in an acceptable fashion for both houses. You know, whether or not then we move to a bill and a vote next week, the week after, that remains to be seen. But clearly, you know, they have a target date of before Christmas to deliver this to the president. So they're going to be moving very quickly. And I think it's really time for citizens to weigh in right now. You can call your members of Congress, tell them not to vote for this tax scam, and let them know that you don't support it and that they shouldn't either, and that you'll remember how they voted in November.
We've been talking with Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of Fiscal Policy Institute. Ron, how do people keep on top of what the Fiscal Policy Institute is doing?
So you can check us out on the web at www.fiscalpolicy.org. I would also recommend, if you want some up-to-date information on the changing nature of the tax bill, that you check out the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities website. That would be www.cbpp.org.
And this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley talking with the executive director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, Ron Deutsch, about the concerns and impacts of the tax bill, will have on the different classes of citizens.
We're now going to move into a second part of our conversation with Dr. David Borton. Dr. Borton has built a solar boat called Solar Sal, and he's very preoccupied with solar energy and the way that solar energy could be a renewable and viable resource as we move through the 21st century. We played a segment earlier in the show in which he was talking about how we measure E equals MC squared and how we measure energy in time. In this part of Dr. Borden's conversation, he speaks about energy and how we actually can value human energy and the way that we are all inextricably linked to the sun.
Okay, we are back in the studio with David Borton to talk about science. Welcome back to WOOC, David.
Oh, it's good to be here. How are you, Megan?
I'm doing well. I'm a little nervous because I don't know what you're going to ask me about. Last time you asked me about basketball, which got us to Newton's three laws of motion and rocket science. We've talked about your measurements, mass, length, and time, which led us to an understanding of E equals MC squared. So what's happening today?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Work.
Okay, so are you putting us to work?
Well, what are you doing right now? Okay, tell me about speaking.
What would you like to know?
How do you do it?
Well, I'm trying to be a little more meditative this holiday season and speak a little less, but I usually just make a noise, like a bird sound.
Good. Okay, so how do you make a noise?
Good reminder to breathe. I open my mouth. I try to think before opening my mouth.
So all of those things take energy, right?
Right.
You're alive. You know, how do you get all these things to happen? Where does the energy come from for you to speak?
Well, that's a good question. Makes me feel like Frankenstein's creature a little bit. I get the energy to be animated to speak from the sun.
That's a great answer. That's almost always correct. So now let's get a little more concrete.
Breathing requires me to oxygenate.
Correct. What's another thing that will kill you if you don't have it?
Water.
Yeah.
Precious, precious water.
Okay. So how long can you go without eating?
I guess if I were lost in the desert somewhere, I would probably last, I'm imagining, 3 weeks, a month?
Yeah, something like that. Now, you mentioned water. How long can you go without water?
Not so long.
Yeah, something like that, a couple of days. Okay, now how about without breathing?
Not long at all. We're getting down to hours and minutes here.
Okay, so where does the oxygen come from that keeps you alive minute by minute?
Well, I know the answer to most everything is, again, the sun.
Well, that's correct. So how does that work? How does the sun give you oxygen?
Take it away.
green plants, right?
Yes.
Green plants give off oxygen. Yeah, so your oxygen that keeps you alive minute by minute is from the sun. Pretty cool, right?
Very cool.
Okay, now you need water, right?
Right.
Do you drink salt water?
No, although I don't mind the taste. I love the ocean, swimming in the ocean.
Okay, but presumably you don't drink salt water.
Right.
So where does the fresh water come from?
Mountain streams.
How does it get into mountain streams?
Condensation dewdrops into a lake on top of an Adirondack Mountain.
Yeah, and how does it get how does it get there?
Water being held in the atmosphere.
Yeah, how does it get in the atmosphere? The answer to everything is...
the sun!
Yes, okay. So the sun distills the water from the oceans, right?
Right.
And it goes up in the clouds, and it comes down as...
rain.
Fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all your fresh water is distilled by the sun. So that's what keeps you alive also. Let's get back to food. Tell me about what you eat.
Angel hair, pasta, green beans, cannolis...
Okay, so where do they come from?
Bella Napoli Bakery, right down the road.
Bella Napoli, it just comes by spontaneous combustion? It just comes out of Bella Napoli?
Well, you know, the sun.
The sun, exactly. Okay, so let's think about that. The sun grows the plants, right? And the plants, you know, get the wheat seeds, then you eat them. Any idea how much energy it takes to put a calorie of wheat into your cannoli? How much solar energy does it take?
Do you want this in precise measurements?
No, of course not. There. I think we talked about the fact that there aren't precise measurements. In mathematics, you can have pure numbers that add up purely, but real things have, you know, some number that has some error to it. So, yes, these numbers are going to have some error to them. But, you know, give me a round ballpark guess for how many calories of solar energy goes into one calorie of food.
100.
Ooh, good guess. Where did you come up with that?
I don't know.
So, how many calories do you eat?
Per day?
Or, you know, any other time.
2,000 per day? I don't know. 3,000? I'm not sure.
Okay, so multiply, I'm not sure, by 365.
No problem. many, many, many hundreds of thousands of calories.
About a million.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So every year you eat about a million calories. Wow.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. So now what do you do?
I enjoy those moments.
What do you do with that food?
Sometimes I record David Borton on the radio. I sometimes go swimming. I sometimes go running.
Good. Do you ever work out on a machine that can actually measure how much energy you're putting out?
I have in the past.
Okay, so give me a number.
In terms of how many calories I put out when I run?
Well,
I never
know
how accurate those digital recorders are.
Do you have a number?
So you run 10 miles and you burn 400 calories or something like that?
Well, let's talk in terms of watts. Army thinks of a person as being worth about 47 watts. How are you compared to a person in the Army?
Much less active, I would say.
All right, well, I'm going to say that you're worth 100 watts, not just 47 watts, but you're worth 100 watts, because that's an easy number. So would you like a job? I can hire you.
Sure.
Okay, sure. Good. All right, so I'm going to pay you what you're worth, and I'm a nice guy. I give you 2 weeks vacation, okay?
Thank you.
I give you a day off a week, so you only work 6 days a week.
Thank you.
I only work you 10 hours a day.
Okay.
Now, this is the hard part. I want you to put out 100 watts for 10 hours a day.
Okay.
There's a chance that Lance Armstrong, when he was doped, could put out 100 watts for 10 hours a day. Do you think you're that level of fitness?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You might see me speeding through the streets of Troy.
If you were to do that, you would make about a million BTUs in 1 year. I'm not saying I could do it. When I was a logger in Alaska, I perhaps could have done that because it was, you know, strong time for me.
Were you really a logger in Alaska?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay, and that was a good summer job from college. It was, oh, that's a wonderful place. One of the things that was great about it was the eating, thinking of food, because every meal was big and every lunch was a picnic lunch in the woods.
Cool.
Okay, so you're worth a million BTUs, and we just said that you ate a million calories. So what's the difference?
Between BTUs and calories?
Yeah.
Oh.
if you have...
This is one of those sad questions.
If you've eaten a million calories, do you think you can put out 2 million calories?
Probably not.
Okay. So it's like...
That's what was always frustrating on those machines.
Yeah. So I'm going to say you're only 25% efficient. I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt here. So that you eat four times as much as the energy you can put out, because that's one of the laws of physics, right? That conservation of energy. You can't get more energy out of something than you put into it. If you did that, it would be called...
Perpetual motion.
Right. Do you believe in that?
Not in the physical world as I see daily existence.
Well, you'd better not. That's one of the laws of physics. Okay, now I'm going to pick a bone with you because you called this, what we're talking about here, practical physics. Do you remember what I call it?
Well, you are calling it equality under the law.
Okay.
Practical physics.
Right. So let's talk about equality under the law. Have you ever broken a law?
Yes, we went over that. Yes.
Okay, so in physics, nobody breaks the laws of physics. And these are laws. The laws that you break are just rules. In this country, we talk about, the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really just the rule of rules. The rule of law is actually the rule of the laws of physics. Equity under the law is, the laws of physics, not necessarily the laws of the land, which are just rules that some people make up that benefit some people and don't benefit everybody. Let's talk about how much energy you use. What kinds of energy do you know of and use other than food?
Well, sadly, fossil fuel energy.
Yeah, correct. Do you have any idea how much of that you use?
No. Oh, man, no. That seems so important.
Yeah, okay, well, it is.
Stay tuned. Dr. David Borton is about to explain how much fossil fuel your average American consumes in the course of a year. The amount's staggering.
That concludes our show. Once again, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kristen Parsons.
And I'm Megan Marone. To learn more about the program and how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, feel free to visit our website, mediasanctuary.org.
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. If you'd like information on how you can participate in the production of this program or have suggestions on stories you'd like to hear about, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org.
Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.